clever experiment, a clever interpretation of the experiment. Immediately the question became, why? Why are these microtubules behaving this way? And the key is, of course, GTP is being hydrolyzed, is being used. Several years later, it was shown for sure, one has chemicals that look like GTP but cannot be hydrolyzed. And when microtubule or tubulin is assembled in the presence of this analog to GTP, microtubules assemble to equilibrium, and they don't undergo these fluctuations. So it's the free energy from the hydrolysis of GTP that's being injected into the system that's causing these dynamics. And that led immediately Michison and Kirchner to propose the first simplest model for why this might occur, called the CAP model. Basically, there are two chemical reactions taking place. Tubulin is aggregating into the microtubule, and then hydrolysis is taking place in the body of the microtubule. This gives two reaction fronts, and when one front, when the aggregation front is winning, then the tube is growing, and if the hydrolysis front by some fluctuation overtakes it, then he proposes the tube starts to shrink. This general CAP model has had problems. It doesn't. The most severe problem that still exists today is that it can't explain the reverse transition of rescue. It has to be put in by hand. And the other problems are that, well, the kinetics of the chemical reactions involved are coupled. This experiment...
Rescue is when it starts growing again, right?
Before it actually totally dissolves, it stops shrinking and starts growing.
The model doesn't stop.
The model has no reason to stop. Because... the hydrolysis rate is a one-way reaction. So hydrolysis is irreversible. The body of the microtubule is all hydrolyzed. You won't have patches that could catch, say, the microtubule. And here at Santa Barbara in Les Wilson's lab, one of the key experiments we've done that has thrown a wrench in the side of the CAP model, showing that microtubule polymerization is coupled to the GTP hydrolysis. That's to say that those two reaction rates aren't independent. Instead of the standard CAP model, which you see up top, you have to have, you basically posit a model which only the terminal row of tubulins has GTP. And this becomes much harder. You can't look to the stochasticity of hydrolysis to give you the stochasticity of the length fluctuations. You can then take the CAP model down to one level deeper that you can't see. What I guess I haven't mentioned is that hydrolysis in proteins often causes them to change their conformation. So often when you see a protein that's catalyzing hydrolysis of ATP or GTP, you can expect that it's undergoing a conformational change. And that's the reasonable hypothesis here as well. That somewhere due to this hydrolysis, the shape of the tubulin molecule is changed that makes the microtubule structure less favorable. But the nature of that shape change is still elusive. The best data on the subject come from some studies under the electron microscope done in vitreous ice. This was from a group based in Germany, where they looked at microtubules in the growing state, and they noticed that the ends tend to be straight but not blunt, straight but jagged, as if the protofilaments are growing somewhat independently of one another. But when they created a solution of microtubules that was primarily in the shortening state and looked, they saw a very different structure in the ends. The ends were now splaying apart and curling back away from the axis of the tube, like a banana. These curls could be long spirals, or they could be short fragments, depending on the conditions that caused the disassembly. This is the shortening phase.
Shortening.
Yeah. And so this is the best direct evidence we have that tubulin is undergoing a conformational change. In one case, at the ends, it prefers to be straight. In the other state, at the ends, it prefers to be curled. Okay. What I'm going to propose to you today is that because tubulin is such a primitive biological molecule, it's a reasonable candidate for something that has the simplest possible conformational change going on. And I'm going to argue that the simplest possible conformational change is unfolding. So I told you that proteins are polymers that tend to be compact. They have lots of structure, but the simplest thing you might describe in a physical sense is that they become less compact or less dense. It's a scalar parameter, and it's very general. It's also simple in a biological sense, because of the subset of amino acid polymers that might condense, that's actually fairly large. And so if all you need is for a sequence to be able to condense and release, you don't place too many constraints on that sequence, it could be allowed it could occur fairly easily, first off, in some sort of random exploration of sequence space. Now this idea is, not entirely my own. In fact, it's not my own. I was inspired by the work of Jan Ho, who came to speak here last December. And he's written a paper in the journal Proteins proposing that there could be functional domains of a single protein that derive their function on the basis that the polypeptide chain undergoes thermal motion. He's a very reasonable fellow, and he wouldn't go about saying that this is the ultimate simplest conformational change. I'll do that. But he did have this very clever idea and show to me, in what I believe is a convincing way, a couple ways in which unfolding could have a biological function. For example, if you have a protein whose shape gives it the ability to bind some sort of a ligand, and in that active site for binding there is a disordered piece of the polypeptide chain, over time it will explore that volume and exclude the ligand from binding. And so you can actually regulate a protein by simply a small chemical modification which would favor the free or, say, condensed version of this region. The other possible application in biological systems might be as a sort of a polymer brush to keep biological structures separated from one another, in analogy to what is done in colloids. Now, good ideas like that are actually, they're actually not so hard to come by in biology. The real hard thing is to prove them. Biology is very good at fooling you with a lot of complexity. But I think that microtubules will give us a system simple enough that we might be able to prove this hypothesis. So what I propose to you is, suppose that this is the nature of the conformational change that's going on in tubulin. Here you have a tubulin dimer, alpha on top and beta on the bottom. And let's suppose that a region of the beta polypeptide chain is held down to the surface when GTP is stuck, is present. However, once this GTP is hydrolyzed, this region is released into solution and explores space like a random coil through a volume that I'll call the random coil domain. Okay, what are the... Yeah?
So when you talk about unfolding, it's this polypeptide chain that's going on and off, that's what you refer to as unfolding?
Yes,
it's I didn't think of the whole sphere.
No, just a domain. A portion of the polypeptide sequence gets less dense.
Not the whole
thing. Not the whole thing. Right. So what would this unfolding, or partial unfolding, do? Suppose that the tubulin molecules are aggregated laterally, like they are in the microtubule lattice. If this random coil domain is larger than the size of the beta sphere, then there will be some overlap between neighboring random coil domains. So this is a face-on view and this is an end-on view. And especially if this aggregate is curved such that these random coil domains appear on the interior of the curve, then there will be a lot of overlap. That overlap represents a region of space where these two polypeptide chains sterically hinder one another, and so they have less entropy. That's going to cost free energy. And the free energy that it costs could drive the radial separation of such an aggregate. So this was a cross-section through the tube. Now let's consider the longitudinal direction. microtubules, remember, are made of these dimers, and we're not proposing that alpha, whose GTP doesn't get hydrolyzed, alpha won't have such a domain. So in the longitudinal direction, the random coil domains would be spaced by twice the distance that they are in the lateral direction. And any amount of overlap, say, between one domain and the neighboring alpha sphere could be relieved by adopting a gentle amount of curvature for the protofilament. In fact, by just measuring this curvature off of those electron microscope pictures, can get an estimate for what the size of this sphere would have to be, or this domain would have to be, you know, just proposing no overlap. And the geometry is fairly simple. The measured radius of curvature of the protofilaments is 19 nanometers. The microtubule, the tubulin diameter is 4 nanometers. And that gives a size, a radius to the random coil domain of 2.7 nanometers.
Is there a reason that when it's straight, you draw in such a way that the spheres don't overlap?
So the size, I drew it actually having done this backwards. So I put in these numbers and found out that this was the right size. And then I drew the picture.
Uh-huh. So they, in fact, they don't overlap. The cube is straight.
That's correct. Uh-huh. They don't overlap in this direction. They overlap only with the neighboring axis.
Not in this. Right, in the longitudinal axis of the cylinder, but along the angular direction.
They do overlap. That's right.
What is the mechanism that
keeps
this smooth bubble always to one side?
So the sphere is actually not spherically symmetric. It's got a very high amount of structure. And we're just proposing that it's a particular region on that sphere that is able to do this. So it's actually pinned. Yes, in fact, I can. And I will show you just now. First, I want to point out to you that this size, 2.7, that we get out of this measurement, implicates a certain number of amino acids just by doing a self-avoiding random walk, which scales as a 3/5 power number of the steps. You get roughly 40 amino acids if you suppose that each amino acid is 3 angstroms. So what we'd like to do is look at the structure of the tubulin molecule and see if there's a region of about 40 amino acids that would be a candidate for unfolding. What's down here is the amino acid sequence of beta tubulin again. And I don't know if you're familiar with what's called the secondary structure of proteins. They come in a local structure of alpha helices and beta sheets. The alpha helices are drawn in pink. Beta sheets are drawn as blue arrows. And what you notice is that there's a region from residue number 24 to residue 110 that actually has fairly little structure that's typical for proteins. Off here, there's also a very unstructured region at the other end. But this whole length here has only one alpha helix, 6 amino acids long. It's fairly minor. And if you take the size of this domain, it's about 84 amino acids long. So now what we start to think is maybe this whole region becomes loose, but it's tethered at both ends to the surface of the beta sphere. The structure, the reason I know that structure of tubulin is it was solved early last year by a group out at Berkeley, or Lawrence Berkeley Labs. It was run by Ken Downey. And it's available for free at the protein database on the web. You can download it and turn it around on your own computer. And this is it. This is the beta tubulin, the way it's folded up. And here, for example, is the GTP. Or actually, in this case, it's GDP. It's been hydrolyzed in the structure that they used. I've highlighted in red those amino acids which I propose are unfolding. And in black are the two neighboring alpha helices, which appear to be fairly well anchored, this alpha helix and that alpha helix, which are interacting strongly with other alpha helices in the structure. So this is an image of the tubulin molecule looking at it from the side, so that on this side is the interior of the tube and on this side is the exterior of the tube. I didn't make that up. That's where it came out. You can take another view looking at it from the bottom to see what gets close to that GDP. Looking up at it from the bottom, there's the GDP. It would have another phosphate extend out to here. And there's actually couple regions which seem to make contact with that phosphate. So this looks kind of plausible in terms of the structure. Now, it also has several consequences. Now we start making predictions based on this hypothesis. Let me give you an example. This is the basic tubulin lattice dimers, and I've drawn on here the random coil domains for a few of the beta tubulins. And I want to show you what happens once these random coil domains are released. Like usual in physical systems, you learn the most from the defects. So we're going to look at the scene. Give me just a moment. Got that wrong. One thing that you'll notice is that the random coils are not distributed symmetrically about the scene. Some of them are closer than others. And so, if the microtubule without random coils forms into this nice cylinder, once the random coils are released, there'll be a tendency to slip and balance the repulsive forces at the seam. I'm going to exaggerate this so that you can see what the consequences of slipping would be for the structure of the tube. When you take a cylinder and you just slip along its seam, what ends up happening is that the filaments no longer run parallel to the axis of the tube. Instead, they start to spiral around. It's called a super twist. So one prediction of the random coils is that there will be some change, or at least some induced super twist, in the tubulin, in the microtubule structure as a result of the hydrolysis of GTP. The other prediction is the fact that if you look at the seam, the repulsion between the neighboring protofilaments at the seam is not so strong as it is between neighboring protofilaments elsewhere.
You keep talking about repulsion. The forces between the alpha and the beta and so on are unknown. They're repulsive?
No. The basic forces that hold the microtubule together are attractive, but the random coils tend to repel one another, or there's some free energy cost just by entropy. Mm-hmm. It's steric hindrance. But that free energy is not, that cost is not so great between this particular pair of protofilaments, simply because they're shifted and they're rather large distance from one another. So those are two predictions. We can check in the literature to see if anything is borne out. First, the simple calculation. Slipping at the seam will cause some amount of super twist. There's the twisting seam, for example. Straightening it out, you get a relationship between the width of the tubule and the distance that was slipped. So if somebody could just tell you what the pitch is of this twist, you would know how much it had slipped. In fact, it's possible to see that under the electron microscope. A French group, under the auspices of Dick Wade, looked at structural changes in microtubules due to hydrolysis by working with the GTP analog, slowly hydrolyzable. In fact, not hydrolyzable on the time scale of the experiments. So what they did is they looked at microtubules made with GTP and then with this analog. The microtubules made with the GTP, hydrolyzed and ended up having GDP in their body, and the others looked as if they never hydrolyzed. So this is a GDP microtubule, though it was assembled with GTP, and this is a GTP microtubule, essentially. It's a little backwards. Anyway, from the electron micrographs, you can get out, you can look at the microtubules and extract out the pattern of their protofilaments. When protofilaments are not running parallel to the axis of the tube, there is a moiré pattern caused by their overlapping with one another in and out of phase. And one can measure the repeat length of this moiré pattern and get at the pitch of the super twist. And that's what they did here. For microtubules that came together with 13, 14, 15, they even did for 12 protofilaments. And so from their numbers, there's a dividing sign that came out. from their numbers we get the pitches before and after hydrolysis, corresponding to some initial amount of mismatch at the seam and some final amount. And the difference between these two numbers is pretty uniformly about 1.5 angstroms. So, under the random coil hypothesis, we predict that there's a 1.5 angstrom slippage taking place at the seam of a microtubule. And though it's not the interpretation of these authors, they did notice a 1.5 angstrom signal in their scattering, in their electron crystallography data. They interpreted differently, but there's definitely a peak that appears to change by 1.5 angstroms. Okay, now what about that other prediction? Well, I mentioned to you, I tried to emphasize the fact that at the seam there isn't as much repulsion, so while all the other protofilaments are going to be splaying outwards and separating from one another, the two that are at the seam might not. They might just stay there with one another. In fact, they could simply rotate slightly apart and relieve all sorts of overlap between them and be a stable protofilament pair. The amount of rotation you can calculate for the given size of the random coil domain ends up being, in fact, the same degree of bend between dimers, between monomers, as is present in the single protofilament coil. That's a little involved, but it's a nice consistency check that the bonds between the protofilaments aren't being stressed an unreasonable amount. Furthermore, a pair of protofilaments is going to be relatively stiff to twisting along the axis, and so has a reasonable chance of spiraling straight backwards and rolling up on itself. It's a little contrived, but I'm only telling you this because it's very well known that in the disassembly products of microtubules, you see such structures, double rings of protofilament pairs. But they'd previously been very enigmatic. I just want to point them out to you since I have them here. Let's see if that's too ambitious. In those original pictures of what disassembling microtubules looked like, yeah, why don't you hold on to this? Thanks. What I want to point out to you is this little thing down here that the authors even noticed. There's another one of them over here. It looks in cross-section like four filaments, and on the opposite side has the same thing, like a double ring of protofilaments. Now, people have made it's possible to separate out these solution products on the basis of their different sedimentation coefficients in centrifugation. And a Spanish group led by Andreu, has solved by X-ray scattering the structure of these rings. And this is what they came up with as a model. And the model is very strange and caused a lot of puzzlement because the inner and outer ring are not attached to one another at all. And they're not in any particular register with one another. So there's really no reason not to think that they wouldn't fall apart perpendicular to their plane. They used a monomer, a set of balls, as their monomeric unit, which was 4 nanometers thick in this dimension, 8 nanometers deep into the board, and 7 nanometers off at an angle 60 degrees to the radial. All of these numbers check out with agree with the model inspired by the random coils. So by plugging in the separation here, it's possible to predict what sort of angle this other axis will have, and it comes out to be close to 60 degrees. Yes, in fact, I do. When these two rings are separated by one another by the random coil domains that are on the interior ring. The interior ring is pressed up against the exterior ring through its random coil domains. And random coil domains will be sufficiently disorganized that they won't show up in X-ray scattering. And yet it's nested in there, so it would make some sense that it doesn't come apart. So, in conclusion, we have I propose that the conformational change of tubulin involves the unfolding of a portion of the beta tubulin molecule to the interior of the microtubule. And I've given you two different structural arguments. And now I come back to the question of my talk. Why, then, is a microtubular tube? And offer to you this notion that it had to be a tube in order to amplify the effect of this primitive conformational change and allow this complicated behavior of dynamic instability. So, in order to follow up along these lines, what are the implications of this hypothesis for dynamic instability? Basically, anything which alters the free energy that's stored in the polymer brush that's formed on the interior of the microtubule should alter the way that the microtubule falls apart. For example, I myself have done a lot of studies of how microtubules' behavior varies as a function of temperature and concentration of tubulin. And one of the interesting pieces of the puzzle that now fits in place is how the velocity at which they shorten scales with temperature. It was always understood that microtubules are more stable at higher temperatures because there's some hydrophobic effect which is mediating their binding. But they also fall apart more quickly at higher temperatures. And this makes sense. The free energy, entropic free energy stored in a brush is going to be greater at higher temperatures. Furthermore, I've looked at, spontaneous nucleation of microtubules, but in this work we also looked at the effect of glycerol, often used to induce nucleation, on the dynamics, and saw that it has, although it's known to stabilize microtubules, it does nothing to enhance their growth rate. Instead, it makes the rate at which they fall apart much, much lower, and what I don't have published here, but I have the data, the rate at which they disassemble also slows. In the case of glycerol, then, what I propose is that this random coil is less hydrated. It's less well solvated by glycerol, and so effectively smaller, giving it less free energy. Okay, so the real question you want to ask is, what is the free energy that would be stored in a polymer brush of random coil domains on the interior of the microtubule? And I'm just going to go over a very intuitive argument for how much energy is stored in a polymer brush. With 1 kT, your typical polymer would like to occupy some typical radius of gyration like we calculated before. If you force these polymers to be too close to one another, smaller than that typical radius of gyration, then they will have to form break up into smaller polymer domains, each undergoing a separate random walk. So, roughly, the free energy that's stored in such a brush is proportional to the number of polymer blobs that any one polymer chain has to go into. What I'm saying is that given the spacing between two polymers, you can calculate how many steps of the polymer are required to make a random walk of the size of that spacing, and then count the number of steps per polymer chain. So because the domain that we found on beta tubulin is anchored at two ends, I propose that they're actually like two independent random coils anchored at half the spacing between betas. So the typical diameter of a beta tubulin, or the inter-beta tubulin spacing, is 4 nanometers, and then that would be have a radius, so then there would be 2 nanometers between domains with a radius of 1 nanometer. When you put the numbers through, basically you come up with something that says that every random coil domain, once it's in this packed configuration, is storing about 5 kT. You can also plug into the scaling arguments of Alexander and get about the same number out. That has to be compared to the free energy that's present in the lateral bonds of the tubulin dimers that are in the lattice of the microtubule. This has been measured recently and found to be about 11 kT go into adding one tubulin molecule, adding a tubulin molecule in a mole of tubulin molecules into the lattice. And since only 4 of the 6 bonds that are made are broken, the whole protofilament stays together, only the 4 lateral bonds are broken, you can bring that down, but it's still significantly larger than the free energy stored in the random coil brush. So this brings us to a model of dynamic instability. The basic idea is that microtubules are actually stable. instead of the cap model, which proposed that the whole microtubule was unstable, held together by something at the very end, we suggest that the microtubule is a metastable structure that is held together by the lateral bonds of the tube. And now, how does it fall apart? I propose a crack model, which says that what you need to do is initiate some sort of a separation between protofilaments at the tip, at the growing end of the microtubule, that can then propagate down into the body and spread around the circumference. And what's nice about this model is that it gives a very natural proposition to explain rescue, the phenomenon that the cap model could never explain. As these curly filaments break off from the microtubules that are disassembling, there is some probability that they will all break off within a reasonable distance of one another, forming a more or less blunt end. A blunt end, even though it's completely hydrolyzed, would be stable. You need to somehow initiate a crack, and a crack won't... the energy barrier to creating a crack in a ring of 13 is quite large, but in between two, say, it's fairly small. So rescue could be a blunt end. And so there's a lot of room for the next phase of more quantitative predictions about how the statistics of these two events should vary with the conditions that alter the random coils. In closing, I just want to come back to the more philosophical scale and say, so there's some hope that biophysics can be more than just the application of physics techniques to biological problems, or even more than just taking biological systems for their material goods and doing some sort of physics on them. That there's really some hope for a subfield of physics which studies biological phenomenon and searches for laws that would let us understand better how nature designs things. And that's it.
Well, thank you for finishing on time.
What does evolution tell you about your random coil domain? Is it less conserved? Is it more conserved?
There are regions of it. This is of. What I want to emphasize is that this domain is just extremely likely from the structure. It doesn't have to be this particular region. It could have some alpha helical nature to it. But if I look at that beta sequence, I think it's in that original stack. There are portions of it which are of the non-conserved type. And then there are other portions which are highly conserved. So you might expect that the regions of it which will have to interact with the GTP, for example, would be fixed evolutionarily. Give me a second. So the punchline is that there are some portions of it. I don't know. I still have to look. I'm sorry. Yeah, there it is. Yes, sir.
You've given a very beautiful description of what I understand is the new axis of microtubules, where you have a receiving layer.
That's correct.
One question is there evidence for, I mean, I guess the first model it was suggested was the symmetrical one,
the A lattice.
All the way around.
Right.
First of all, is there any evidence for the existence of that? And secondly, I understand in the neuron, one does have microtubules which don't undergo this fluorinated sequence. And is there any possibility that those might be A lattice?
Let's see. Okay, so let me first give you the introduction. There are different ways that the tubular lattice could come together. And in general, it's been seen in the majority of biological systems that you get this B lattice, the one that has the defect running down the seam. It's also possible to arrange the angle between neighboring protofilaments in order that you get perfect helicity. I am not familiar. There are probably people maybe more familiar than I, maybe less, who can answer about any instances of the A lattice known in biological systems.
Perhaps for the non-expert, you can say the A lattice is the one without the C.
Yes, the A lattice is the one without the C.
And Roger's question is that somehow in neurons,
there's a host of proteins. There's a host of proteins that have functions of modulating microtubule behavior, and neurons are full of protein called tau and a couple other MATs, MAPs, microtubule-associated proteins, whose function it is to stabilize microtubules. So it's still possible that you have B lattices and stable microtubules. Yes, Les, please. So it's a doublet, so it has another B lattice coming off of it? No, okay.
The question about stability of neuronal microtubules, I think, could be due to the various microtubule associated proteins that we find to the surface, tau and so forth, that reduce the ability of microtubules to build the children. And so that's one.
Yes.
Did I understand correctly that in the process of uncoiling, the slippage occurred on the seam of the whole microtubule?
I propose that slippage occurs on the seam during growth. That it's not it's as soon as hydrolysis happens, which is known to be very close to growth, then there's the release of these domains and they force a slippage. And then the process that ignites the falling apart of the microtubule is different. Yes, Cole.
You mentioned that you postulated the existence of a link of random walking. Part of the beta sequence does about 40 nanomers, 40
amino acids long?
40 amino acids. Do we see that here, that there should be a length of about 40 amino acids?
Yes.
That are more like random.
Oh, about the random between species, it's something that I haven't looked into enough to say with confidence. But about the random within the structure of microtubules as is known, this is the wrong perspective. What you see here is the region. Again, it's about 80 long instead of 40. But it has a long portion of it which is really sort of drawn in. It's not very strongly confined by the X-ray scattering. It's essentially random coil as it is in this crystal structure that was solved to get at the structure of the tubulin.
What I mean is, in the evolution of this protein, should we see that
that this region, right, right, so let me point out to you that occupies amino acids 21 to 110. And that would be starting at this W right here and going until that E over there. Now this region over here is very highly conserved. So that does not, but it's off at the end of this random coil domain. There are significant gaps in here which are not particularly conserved. But I have to, now there's some burden on the hypothesis to show that the parts that are highly conserved are actually binding to GTP or doing something. And I don't have that information yet.
When you say that this tubulin is very primitive and it's the same throughout species, it's more similar between species than other proteins?
Yes.
Much more.
Can you quantify those things? Certainly. What people sometimes specify is the percent homology in sequences. And I think it comes out to be about 40% in microtubules, which is huge, as opposed to some things. I don't know another thing to reference you against, but I think numbers more than 10% are characteristic.
And mutation rates are known or not known?
when you know that two organisms have the same protein, like hemoglobin or something like that, then you can look at their sequences and compare and see how many, how much they're alike or different. And that can be quantified. It's not, the problem of deducing from that the rate of mutation over long periods of time is still being worked on. I don't know that that's so easy to do yet.
So what are the experiments?
Oh, yes. So one most desirable experiment would be to go here to the tubulin molecule and create a mutated form that lacks some of these amino acids. Just remove some. Make this domain shorter. By 10 amino acids would be enough to change the curvature of the protofilaments and possibly not really change much about the rest of the dynamics. Unfortunately, this is difficult to do in the tubulin system, so we have to start doing experimental tricks to mimic what that is. That kind of genetic manipulation is only really easy in bacteria, and when you make tubulin in bacteria who don't usually have it, the tubulin that comes out isn't functional. So you don't have a good handle on the genetics. So you might try using a kind of protein called a protease that is specific for cutting up other protein and hopefully cut right in this region and relieve some of the random coil domain by just removing it out. There is a protease map of tubulin. One protease does nick in this region. It also nicks elsewhere, so you always have a little bit of trouble making sure that any change you see is due to the one that you wanted. But we're pursuing that kind of line as well. Another experimental route is to come up with more quantitative predictions on catastrophe and rescue and go and measure those as a function of various agents that would perturb the random coil. And finally, nucleation of microtubules. The spontaneous nucleation of microtubules is going to be very sensitive to the size of the random coil. And there's a prediction which comes out that says that the size of microtubule that forms from the pre-critical aggregate of a sheet will be larger, will have more protofilaments on it, have to take up a smaller radius of curvature if those protofilaments are already populated by random coil domains. So here's a prediction about how the protofilament number of a population of microtubules should depend on the rate at which they were nucleated. And we're pursuing that experiment now. Mark? What it does is control the statistics. So it can, if you take out certain proteins from the cell and put it on your pure microtubule system, you see a change in the relative probabilities of growth and shrinking, as well as the rates. But it doesn't necessarily just go and assemble a microtubule bit by bit with a certain helper protein.
Question.
Yes. No, it is condensed onto the surface in the presence of GTP. The hypothesis is that GTP must bind to some regions which hold it in, and that only when the aggregate, when it fits into the aggregate and the GTP is hydrolyzed, do these regions no longer strongly bound escape to the interior. It would never appear on the outside of the microtubule. Is that what you mean?
No, I mean,
yeah. Yes. In the presence of zinc ions, you can actually get tubulin protofilaments to assemble instead of like this, like that, so that they are anti-parallel and back to front. And those are two-dimensional sheets called zinc sheets. That's how the crystallography that got the structure was done. And they don't show any tendency for curvature.
The parts of the coil that would be candidate to bind to GTP, would those be the parts that show
nucleation? That would be the prediction.
Further questions? Let's thank the speaker again.
Thanks.